It seems that every few years we hear that classical music is dying. But research from the National Endowment for the Arts tells us differently. Classical music is alive and well, but living in a changed world. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to celebrate Public Radio Music Month with a short course in music appreciation. We'll have a listening session with Lisa Ponton, principal violist with Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids, and Michael Eagle, artistic director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. We'll also take the pulse of the classical music scene in Iowa, and we want to hear from you. How do you listen to classical music? How has that changed in recent years? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to celebrate Public Radio Music Month with a short course in music appreciation. According to a study released by the National Endowment for the Arts in 2011, even though audiences for classical music performances have been steadily declining nationwide, interest in classical music remains strong. It's just that people are listening to the music they love in new ways. This hour, we'll learn a little bit about the strength of the classical music scene in Iowa, and we'll also talk about how to engage a new audience. With me today is Lisa Ponton. She is principal violist with Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And also with us is Michael Eagle. He's artistic director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And before we jump into talking about different pieces of music, I want to get a little bit of each of your backgrounds. And Lisa, I know you've been in Iowa since 2008, so you came to Cedar Rapids in 2008, just before
that's
the floods.
That's right. My husband and I, actually, we bought our home, moved here a week before the flood. And, you know, bam, everything changed.
Well, in Orchestra Iowa, for people who don't know, your home theater is the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids, which was devastated by the flooding
that's
in
right.
2008.
I never actually got to see the old Paramount. It was gone before I even set foot in it. And so the first 4 years of my time here, you know, we were playing in all sorts of other venues. But this year, we finally got back to the Paramount, and it's just gorgeous.
It is beautiful.
And we're really excited.
So I'm not going to ask you about how the audience has evolved in your time here, because as you've been traveling around performing in different venues, I'm sure it's been different.
That's
everywhere
right.
you've
sure.
gone. And I know people are very, very excited to have Orchestra Iowa back in their home theater in Cedar Rapids. So I'm sure audience has been very strong this year.
It has been. And, you know, I have to say that we had a very loyal following. There, you know, there were people who stuck with us, you know, through those years when we were nomads, and we're really appreciative of that. But it is so great to be back. And we're hoping the audiences will, you know, will come back and see us back home.
Michael, how long have you been with the Des Moines Metro Opera?
Well, that's an interesting question. I admit to being associated with the company now. This will be my 20th summer season. I started 20 years ago as an intern and have been with the company off and on, mainly full-time, for the last 13 years now, most recently as the artistic director.
Can you give me an idea? Now, you have some longevity with the organization. How have you seen the audience evolve in that time?
Well, much like Orchestra Iowa, we are very fortunate to have a loyal audience of people from the Des Moines area as well as from other parts of our region that come to the festival every year. I think we have an advantage in a certain sense that we're a festival company, which means that all of our performances, rather than being spread out throughout the year, are concentrated into a weekend or a summer setting. That makes it accessible and an ideal travel spot for people to come from Minneapolis, from St. Louis, from Chicago, from Kansas City, from Omaha, and around the state of Iowa to see three operas in one weekend. And we've been very fortunate to see that audience continue to stay with us, but also to grow. Anecdotally, just for this season coming up this year, 2013, we're seeing a significant rise in people coming from Minneapolis and the Chicago area to see the unusual repertory that we've programmed for this year.
And that stayed strong even through the recession?
It has. It has. We've, you know, as I say, we've been very fortunate to have a strong audience base. And the number of new ticket buyers, the people who are coming for the first time, continues to increase slightly, if not, you know, stay the same in some of the years in the recession. But we've seen a slight decrease in audience members, but not a significant one.
So when you hear reports about the death of classical music performance and audiences declining dramatically around the nation, and, you know, people like to be very dramatic when they write pieces about that, but what is your response?
Well, you know, people have been saying that for a very long time, I think. It's not a new thing. It's not a recent Hail Mary cry, I guess. That's nothing new. I always point to things like, you know, there's a survey from Opera America that often the service organization for opera that says that the audience for opera, people between the ages of 18 and 40, is the fastest growing of any art form in the United States. I'm also encouraged by the popularity of the Metropolitan Opera's Live in HD series that came out. I think it's been about 6 or 7 years ago, where live transmissions from the stage of the Metropolitan are transmitted to movie theaters around the United States, actually around the world. And the audience for that has been quite remarkable. I feel that through, you know, those kinds of performances and our opera companies, much like ours, going out into schools and into the community in unique and interesting ways, that the appetite for opera actually seems to me to be on the increase and growing. I always say that a rising tide raises all boats, and I think that the Met in Live in HD series have been very helpful for us as a company.
I think that there still is, for some people, a level of intimidation when they think about opera or classical music. If they're someone who has never gone to a performance before, I think that people still might think, but I won't know when to clap, and I won't know what to do. Lisa, have you, in your observations of audiences, what would you say to someone to put them at ease?
Well, you know, I'd say a few things. First of all, I wouldn't worry about that so much. You know, music is all about the way it makes you feel, and the better the music, the more you know, the more effective the composer and the music will be in making you feel an emotion. And you don't really need to know anything, you know, to have a reaction to something. I always sort of think of maybe an audience member who hasn't heard a lot of music as myself. When I go to an art museum or something, you know, I don't know anything about art at all. I know, you know, Da Vinci painted the Mona Lisa, and I know Van Gogh cut off his ear, and that's like what I know, you know? So when I go to a museum and I just see sort of like rows and rows of paintings, you know, and pots and things, I can, you know, I can look and I can say, oh, well, you know, that's very pretty. But I don't necessarily, you know, I can't experience it in a very deep way. But once in a while, you know, you'll see a painting that you just have a really gut reaction to. And my family was just in Chicago last month over spring break, and we went to the Art Institute actually to see Grant Wood's American Gothic. Orchestra Iowa's commissioned Michael Dougherty to write a piece based on American Gothic, which we're premiering in May. And so we wanted to go see it. So, and we did. And then we were wandering the halls, you know, and I turned a corner and there was this painting by Georgia O'Keeffe called Yellow Hickory Leaves with Daisy, you know, and it was a very simple painting, but I looked at it and it just made me smile, you know, it just made me really happy. And then there was another one by Jackson Pollock who was called Grayed Rainbow, I think. And it had it, and I had another sort of just gut reaction. It was, you know, this very gray, black texture, and it just made you feel sort of like a bleak rainy day like today. It was just really amazing and powerful. And like I said, I can't tell you all the reasons why, and I can't tell you anything about their technique or anything, but I had a real gut reaction. And that's, you know, and that's what you want first and foremost. Certainly if you know, you know, if you know things, if you know what to look for and what to listen to or see, you can have a much richer, deeper experience, but you don't really need to know a lot to just, you know, have that emotional experience, which is, you know, which is what it's all about.
Well, and Michael, if some people find classical music to be intimidating, I think a lot of people actually find opera to be intimidating. What do you do to engage a new audience and to create a gateway?
Well, you know, I'd never accept the fact that if somebody says to me, I don't like opera, I refuse to accept that. It's not it's just not possible. You know, we have the advantage in opera of not just, you know, the orchestra and the singing and the music, but we have an extraordinary visual component to things. And in our theater, our very unique and special theater, it's put right into your lap so that you can experience opera, you can experience the singing in a very visceral way, that you are a part of the story. You're so close to it. You know, if somebody says to me they don't like opera, I just think that's just too broad a statement to make. It's akin to me if somebody's saying, well, I just don't like the movies. Well, you know, you may not like horror movies or you may not like action movies, but you might like a romantic comedy. You might like a period drama. You might like an animated film. I've been in this business now for 20 years, and I still find even some of the greatest pieces that I don't know when I come to them really fresh for the first time, being acquainted with them but not knowing them intimately and just being absolutely blown away. Every year of my life, there's at least one or two pieces that I come to that I just am beginning to learn deeply for the first time. And it's amazing, the variety of types of music. You may not like Mozart, but you might love Puccini. You may like Verdi, you might not like American opera, you might like American opera but not like German opera, or you might like all of them. But the point is that they're all so very, very different and so very visceral. It's such an incredible combination of all of the greatest things that I think humankind has ever created. Sublime orchestral music, extraordinary singing, great theater, costuming, scenery, architecture, art, everything thrown into one package and operating in a unified whole and yet on so many different levels. I just can't imagine what there isn't there to like, what there's not to like about that. It's just remarkable. We spend a lot of time working in outreach and education. We have a successful Opera Iowa program that's been traveling to schools and communities around the state for 27 years. And in those 27 years, we estimate that they have introduced opera and music to well over 750,000 children and adults throughout the state, actually 9 surrounding states and China and Japan as well. And the result of that, you know, we're seeing after 27 years, people in the audience, people working for the opera, people who have pursued careers in singing, who were first exposed to this magnificent art form at a young age through Opera Iowa. And it's programs like that, I think, when you get people hooked at a very early age, that pay dividends in the future. And certainly we're seeing that today, 27 years after the founding of that program.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're actually going to listen to some music that Lisa Ponton, principal violist with Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids, has selected for us. And then later on in the hour, Michael Eagle, artistic director with the Des Moines Metropolitan Opera, has also selected some pieces for us to listen to with him and get some insight on what we can get out of listening to this music and how to make this music more accessible to audiences. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air this morning at 11.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating Public Radio Music Month, and we're talking this hour about classical music and opera in Iowa. With me, Michael Eagle, Artistic Director of the Des Moines Metro Opera, and he's brought with him some samples of opera music for us to listen to together today. We're going to get to that a little bit later. Also with me is Lisa Ponton. She's Principal Violist with Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids, and she also has brought music with her today to share with us. And Lisa, before the break, we were talking about how, from your perspective, anyone can appreciate a thing of beauty, even if they don't know anything about it. But now we'd like you to give us a little bit of an education.
Well, sure. I mean, there are a lot of ways that you can listen to a piece of music that you can, you know, sort of, I guess, take it apart or learn what to listen to. You know, some of the most obvious things are melody. You know, what is the melody? Who's got it? You know, in orchestral music, it rarely stays in one place. It's usually being passed around the various members of the orchestra. And so just tracking the melody throughout can be a really interesting, you know, fun way to listen. Certainly harmony plays a part, the sort of tension and release of different harmonies and different colors is really great. Rhythm, which is so basic to just about every culture, is always something that you can pick up on and try to identify with what the rhythm is. The different sounds of the orchestra, different layers, the energy, there are so many things that you can pick up on. I have to say, for those who want to learn more about those things, some of the greatest resources still around are the Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts that he did in the late 50s through the early 70s. Those are just such amazing, tools for learning how to listen. He approaches really complicated subjects in such an engaging and logical and approachable way. You know, I find them still really fascinating. And you can get those on DVD. There are also transcripts in book form. And those are just terrific resources for learning, learning how to listen. So depending on the piece, there are different entry points. So to say, there are different things that may be more relevant to a certain piece. When I think back to these paintings that I saw that I found so fascinating, I think one of the things that made me respond the way I did were the use of color in the one that made me so happy, the yellow hickory leaves. It was just this really vivid yellow color, that just makes you happy when you see it. It's like when I see one of those yellow Volkswagen Beetles, and you see that yellow one, and it just brightens up everything. It makes you smile. It makes everything else seem kind of drab. And with the other one, with the Jackson Pollock, it was again just the way the colors were interweaving to give you that feeling of a rainy day. Music has colors as well. In an orchestra, we have four basic instrument groups. We have the strings, we have the winds, we have the brass and the percussion, and each group has its own color, its own. And then within each group, each instrument has its own unique color. Or actually, when we talk about sound, we usually call it timbre, but color works just as well. And then even on any particular instrument, you have a range of color. And for example, on a stringed instrument like what I play, each string has its own unique color. And so a good composer, will know exactly what color to choose for the effect that he wants, or, combination of colors. So I've picked three short examples of pieces that are on Orchestra Iowa's upcoming season, our 2013-2014 season. These happen to be some of my favorites and some of my favorite moments of these pieces. So I hope the listeners will be as excited about them as I am.
And the first one you chose is Johannes Brahms' String Quintet. What do you want us to hear when we're listening to this piece?
Speaking of color, when you first hear it, you're going to hear this sort of burst of energy from the upper strings. And it's a really unusual technique that he uses. It's something that's called bariolage, which is a French term that simply means multicolored. And what he's done is I'll see if I can demonstrate.
And Lisa did bring her viola.
I didn't mention that I'm not sure how much I can use it here. But what he does in the beginning is instead of just playing something on one string, as one could do, it's this technique of crossing the string to give a different color. So you have a higher string. You see it's kind of bright, and you have a slightly lower string. And so when you play across the strings, it makes a color. Well, what he's done is he's done something really amazing. So he's got two people going in this direction in harmony together to make these chords. And then he's got two people going in the opposite direction. So you have this like kaleidoscope, of sound right in the beginning. It's like sun on rushing water or something. It's just this extraordinary, effect. And it's just exhilarating. I love it. And then the cello, the very lowest instrument, comes in with this very heroic, again, just exuberant theme. He starts in the lowest part of his register, and then he works his way up to the very highest, the most intense part. And so it just goes from very powerful to very intense. It's just really exciting. Another thing that's really cool about this piece, this is a quintet. In the string world, the sort of gold standard of instrument of ensembles is the quartet, which is two violins, viola, and cello. And this is sort of likened to a choir, where you usually have two you know, a higher and a lower female voice and a higher and a lower male voice. And so the quartet is sort of considered the perfect ensemble. So this is a quintet. There's an added viola, which adds an extra richness to the color, to the texture that's just, you know, wonderful. So, you know, what I love about this is its color, its intensity, its energy, and also just all the driving rhythms of this section. So here's about, I think we have about a minute of this. So
all right, let's listen. Just a selection from Johannes Brahms' string quintet that certainly brightens up a rainy morning.
How can you not love
right?
that? Yeah. You know, something else that Michael touched on that I just wanted to mention with this piece. I remember the first time I heard it, I saw it. Not only was I just blown away by the music, but this is such a visual piece. You know, he was talking about, you know, this visceral experience. You know, when you see bows flying and you see, you know, the cellist traversing an incredible distance in a really short amount of time, it's really exciting to watch. And that's something about live performance, you know, that you don't get. It's great to listen to music, certainly, you know, on a recording. But the live experience of watching the step happening, you know, of seeing the violinist working really hard, of, you know, seeing the oboe turning that alarming shade of purple, you know, and, you know, the percussion guys, they're always doing something, you know, interesting. And, you know, the composer gesticulating, and it's just, it is a very visual experience as well, and something about, you know, sharing this with an audience, you know, with your fellow man, you know, is really exciting. It should be an experience, not just you know, listening. It should be a real experience. Maybe we should go on to the next one.
Yes.
So the next piece, again, this is one of my favorites from our upcoming season at Orchestra Iowa. This is from our symphonic series. This is the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Beethoven himself thought he did a really good job. He was really pleased with this work. It starts off really simply, and again, you know, rhythm is always very important. It starts off with a very simple theme in just the lower string. So again, we have this sort of dark color, and then we have this a rhythmic element, and I'll see if I can just play a little bit. This is the rhythm that you'll hear throughout this entire segment. It never, ever, ever goes away. And that rhythm develops into a tune, a melody. And then when the strings have finished playing this, they add a second melody, which I'll just play the beginning of it. They take over the second melody, and then the second violins come in with the original tune, and they play through all of that, and then the lower strings go in an accompaniment role. The second violins take over the second melody that they played, and then the first violins come in with the first one. So there's just this layering on, you know, one on top of another of each instrument group coming in first with the first melody, and then with the second melody, and then, you know, receding, and then finally everybody piles in, you know, at the end, and there's just this glorious, you know, just wash of sound. It's one of my favorite moments, and as a player too, it's great to play and being, you know, inside this texture. It's just a wonderful experience.
And we're going to listen to a little longer segment of this so that we can hear all of these different layers being added.
Right.
Okay. Let's listen. This is Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, Second Movement. We've been listening to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the second movement, and listening to all of those layers being built upon each other. With me is Lisa Ponton. She's principal violist with Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids. And this hour, we're talking about classical music and opera in Iowa and creating a gateway for those of us who may not be comfortable in those worlds. And Lisa, we're nearly out of time for this segment, so I want to move right on to the last piece that you brought with you today, which is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.
Right. So this is from our upcoming season. Again, in 2013-2014, we're just wrapping up our first season of a really exciting partnership with Ballet Quad Cities, and we're actually we're going to be doing Cinderella with them in Davenport this weekend. Next season, we'll be bringing back the Nutcracker, of course, but the thing that I am just so excited about and I just can't wait is we're doing a production of The Rite of Spring. This piece is often performed as just a concert piece, but, you know, that added dimension of the ballet is going to be really exciting. I was talking about one of the things that's something a part of all cultures is rhythm. And this is just all about the rhythm. This has just got really exciting, really primitive rhythms. The subtitle of this was originally Pictures from Pagan Russia. And you can just see people, you know, with their, I don't know, spears or some, you know, banging sticks and stuff. It's really primitive stuff. Leonard Bernstein called this prehistoric jazz. And I can't think of a better description. This just hits you like on a very primitive gut level. And it's really exciting music. So I'll just let you play it.
All right. We've been listening to just a piece of Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. It will be performed as a ballet with Orchestra Iowa and the Quad Cities Ballet Quad Cities during this upcoming season. This hour, we're talking about classical music and opera in Iowa. With me, Lisa Ponton. She's principal violist with Orchestra Iowa, based in Cedar Rapids. Michael Eagle is also here. He is artistic director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. And we're going to be shifting gears in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be shifting gears and focusing our energy on opera for the final segment of the show today. But this is our celebration of Public Radio Music Month, and we're also talking about how to engage new audiences in classical music and opera. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're celebrating Public Radio Music Month with a short course in music appreciation. And Michael Eagle is with me now. He is artistic director with Des Moines Metropolitan Opera. And Michael, we're going to focus the spotlight on you and opera now. And we just heard some wonderful selections of different classical pieces. And you have also brought with you some selections from an opera, but a specific opera. They're all from the same opera, right?
That's right. I was interested in Lisa's selection of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, which indeed is one of the most significant, most important contributions to the entire musical repertoire of the 20th century. I, as a person who deals primarily in opera, now that the 20th century is over, I'm often asked and often spend some time reflecting about what are some of the most significant contributions that the 20th century made to a long history of operatic works. And for me, that boils down to three operas. And of course, I'm maybe being a heretic and throwing out Puccini from the 20th century, but I just don't think he belongs to the 20th century. He's really more of a neo-romantic composer. So that aside, you know, my answer to that question is always Porgy and Bess of Gershwin, Wozzeck of Alban Berg, and then this opera that I want to talk about today, Peter Grimes of Benjamin Britten. I think now that the 20th century is over, as a person who deals in vocal music and opera and sometimes in choral music, that Benjamin Britten is really one of the titans of the 20th century. And one of the first and most interestingly enough, one of the only English composers to have really stood on an international stage and claimed his own there on that stage. Given a large body of works that he produced in his lifetime and the fact that many of them still hold the world stages today, I have to say that I think he's probably the most significant operatic composer of the 20th century, certainly a personal favorite of mine. Boy, the task of picking out something to talk about today is an immense one for me. I spend I can spend a good portion of a year in class sessions talking about the greatest and most important pieces of opera in the repertoire. It's something that's very fascinating to me. But I chose to talk about Peter Grimes partly because it's part of Des Moines Metro Opera's season this year, but because it's just such a remarkable work. I brought several excerpts with me today, and maybe we can just hear a little bit of a snippet of the first one that I brought, which is from Peter Grimes. It's the famous Embroidery Aria, maybe the most famous piece from Peter Grimes, and it is the aria of Ellen Orford, one of the principal characters in the piece. It comes a little bit later in the opera where she has begun to piece together several different clues about the truth of a situation with Peter Grimes, and I'll talk more about the plot after we hear this excerpt. But she talks about she's found a sweater that she knitted for a boy who has disappeared, and it's in tatters, it's in torn. It's called the Embroidery Aria because she embroidered this sweater for him, and you hear the sound of the needles of the embroidery while she sings in the rhythm and in the feel of the music. And she talks about how at this point in time when she's found this sweater on the seaside, the clues to the mystery that it has afforded her.
All right, let's listen. Just a moment from Embroidery. This is from the opera Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten, and I'm talking with Michael Eagle, Artistic Director with the Des Moines Metropolitan Opera. And Michael, this is an opera that is in English, which a lot of people probably find to be extremely accessible.
Yes.
But it sounds... And this has been my experience with opera, that my experience has been better if I go into the performance with a pretty good understanding of the plot line and what I'm going to see. Do you find that that's true for most audiences?
Oh, that's very true, and I'm glad you mentioned the English business. Yes, there are indeed operas in English, and it certainly does help to, I think, have an idea of what the story is as you go into the opera. Of course, even when we perform in English and certainly in foreign languages, we always have projected supertitles above the stage so that you can follow the action very easily. I always, you know, sometimes in some operas, I encourage people, if they're very interested in learning about it in advance, to order a highlight CD or check out some clips. But you don't have to always listen actively. I learn the most about music and operas I'm trying to learn, not just by, you know, buying the CD and sitting down and putting on a set of headsets and sitting there for, you know, a couple of hours and pounding it into my mind, but just to listen to it, you know, as you're driving or as you're doing work. I learn Mozart's Così fan tutte that way. I always play it when I'm doing laundry and cleaning and things like that. And it's just by now I'll have the thing memorized because it just fits so well. And you don't have to study it. It can seep into your conscious in different ways. And then when you go into the opera house, it feels comfortable. It feels like just slipping into a comfortable book or a comfortable pair of pants or something like that. It feels familiar. And that's always a nice way to do things.
I remember when super titles were introduced, there was some controversy about them, some concern that they would distract from actually watching the performance. Do you find that?
I don't find that. I find that they are a very natural part of the experience now for many people. And, you know, there are viewers or audience members who don't pay any attention to them at all. And you don't need to, should you not want to, especially in something like this that's in English. But if it's there, it's definitely a positive tool.
How important do you think the lyrics are to listening to opera?
Very important, very important. Every composer, from Mozart to Wagner to Puccini and all of them in between, labored and toiled over finding just the right person to write text for them, or if they wrote it themselves, of getting it just right and then reflecting that through the music. It's very important. It doesn't mean that it's critical, but I think your enjoyment is enhanced greatly by an understanding of the text and how the text and music are working together.
You brought another selection. Tell me about the next one.
Well, I should say that Peter Grimes is such a remarkable opera. It was written in 1945, and as I say, I still think it's one of the titans of the 20th century. It was composed as a result of World War II, as a reaction to World War II. Benjamin Britten was a conscientious objector to the war and found himself in a self-imposed exile in San Diego, where he became enamored with this poem in California, called The Burrow by George Crabbe, which depicts rather unfavorably denizens and characters from an English fishing village on the northern coast of England. And he became so taken by this, he won a grant from the Koussevitzky Foundation to set an opera, and he just began to write this opera about Peter Grimes. It was his first major opera, his first major success. It was commissioned for the reopening of Sadler's Wells, a major company in England following the war. Now, it would have been easy for them to have picked a piece like Traviata or Madame Butterfly to celebrate the reopening, but instead they took a real chance in making a statement by picking an unknown composer and a very unusual new work. As a theme in all of his operas, Benjamin Britten was always concerned, both as a pacifist and as a homosexual, with how a society deals with an outsider, and sometimes that's dealt with in a comic setting, in a comic opera like Albert Herring. But in Grimes, we're dealing with somebody who is a fisherman, who is misunderstood, who has been involved in mysterious circumstances, accidental circumstances in the disappearance or the death of some of his fishing assistants, some apprentice boys who has been with him. We never are meant to really know what happened there, but we are meant to see how both the outsider himself reacts to pressure from the society who believes things about him that may or may not be true. The next two excerpts I have are remarkable pieces of opera, and it deals with, you know, the sea is such a big part of this opera, and how the people that live close to the sea are very much at the mercy of the mood of the sea. Sometimes it's calm and beautiful and serene, and other times it's quite violent and drives them into community centers to wait out the storm. The first excerpt I want to play is a piece when the entire village is hiding in the community center, being pummeled by a major storm that's blown in from the course, from the coast, and they sing this round, this canon, Old Joe Has Gone Fishing, to kind of distract themselves from the terror that surrounds them outside. So we'll just hear just a few seconds of this.
Joe has gone fishing, and young Joe has gone fishing, and you know has gone fishing, and found them ashore.
Old Joe has gone fishing.
It's such a remarkable thing. It's, you know, an old sort of folk song given a very sophisticated treatment in a canon kind of form. You know, every character comes in and starts where the last one left off, and then the next one moves on to the next statement of the theme. A very great piece. And it builds to an extraordinary climax as all of the voices add into it. And then at the height of the storm, the door blows open and Peter Grimes comes in, also wanting shelter from the storm, being a denizen of the city, but they really don't want him there. He comes in, he sings, as the storm is breaking away, he sings this beautiful aria about the constellation and makes some points about how humanity has treated him. This is called Now the Great Bear in Pleiades, where you can just kind of hear in the music the storm disappearing and the stars becoming visible again after major weather event.
We're listening to excerpts from the opera Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten with Michael Eagle, Artistic Director with the Des Moines Metropolitan Opera. And obviously the music can do so much to set the scene, to set the tone, to convey emotion. How important is it to also back that up with the scenery and the kind of effects that you can do on a stage today?
It's a very good question, and it's almost a program all of its own. You know, the one of the genius things about this piece are the Great Sea Interludes, which are orchestral pieces that Benjamin Britten wrote to punctuate the scene changes in the opera, and sometimes the scene changes happen over them. But they are such beautiful orchestral depictions of different moods of the sea, from the most violent to the most serene. Oftentimes they're played by orchestras as a suite, the sea interludes from Peter Grimes. They're just remarkable. But of course, you mentioned, you know, you hit the nail on the head. The visual part of things is such an important part of things for me as an artistic director, to choose not just people with extraordinary voices, but people who look the part. I think that's a new thing, a new development in opera, and one of the reasons why it's growing in popularity. We're in a phase now where maybe more so than 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, people are very concerned about singers being actors and singers looking the parts that they're playing and having that dramatic viability in addition to the vocal credibility. It certainly puts a lot more responsibility on the singer, a lot more pressure on the singer to not only sing well, but to physically inhabit a role in a way that previous generations was not quite as important as it is now. But of course, you've got all those these elements that go into it: scenery, costumes, lighting. We're very lucky to have talented production designers who understand the music and the vocal requirements, and who can bring to bear visual elements that really reflect that music. Our current production of Peter Grimes that we're designing this summer relies heavily on the art of John Piper, who's a painter in pre-World War II and World War II England, who was charged by the British government with going around and painting the cities, the towns, the seascapes of England, both before the bombing started and after. And his paintings are really expressionistic in a way. And we've used that. We've gotten several volumes and images of his work, particularly in the northern English seacoast, that will be the basis for our production design. And that we believe is such a critical part of what we're trying to say about this piece. It was born out of World War II, and we'll be setting it in post-World War II London, England, and the landscape will reflect not just the feeling and the mood of the time, but I think the art and music of the time as well.
And Michael, we are out of time. We're going to go out today with the final chorus from this opera from Peter Grimes, but thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Michael Eagle, Artistic Director of the Des Moines Metro Opera. And Lisa Ponton, thank you so much for being here today as
well. Thank you so much, Charity.
Lisa Ponton, Principal Violist with Orchestra Iowa in Cedar Rapids. And again, we're going out with the final chorus from Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from John Pemble. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a journey down the Mississippi with one man in a canoe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.